Hello again, everyone, wherever you may be, and welcome to the 145th edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my longtime partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Leading Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good to be here, Dennis.
Laura, we have so much to talk about tonight, including state Democratic Party leaders in a rift with college Democrats over Israel and city and school board elections taking place tomorrow, Tuesday, in Iowa. But first, our big story on Capitol Week and one of the biggest in the country politically, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds endorsing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in the Republican presidential primary race, the governor announcing her endorsement at a Des Moines rally for DeSantis this very evening. Laura, it's a big win for the Florida governor. What does it mean?
It is. I don't think it means very much for the outcome on January 15th, but I think that for the people who are leaning toward DeSantis, this is a strong signal to them that they should stick with it. And clearly, Governor Reynolds is hoping that this will invigorate Ron DeSantis going into the next debate that's happening later this week. And so far, the narrative recently has not been good for DeSantis, and he really needs a strong showing in Iowa in order to make a real contest for the nomination.
In the latest Des Moines Register Iowa caucus poll, Trump leads DeSantis and Nikki Haley 43-16%. Now, the governor told the Des Moines Register this evening, right before her appearance at the DeSantis rally, that she's endorsing DeSantis because the country is at what she called an unprecedented moment, and the GOP cannot gamble on another Trump candidacy. She said, quote, "I do not believe Trump can win."
And we discussed this last week. I mean, a lot of money has been spent by conservative groups to try to convince Republican voters that Donald Trump is too risky and he can't beat Joe Biden, and we need somebody who would beat Joe Biden. First of all, the polling doesn't really suggests that it's a foregone conclusion that Joe Biden would beat Donald Trump. And also, I haven't seen polling that suggests Ron DeSantis would do much better. But that, in any case, I mean, that is the message that they're sticking with. And we'll see. So far, the Republican primary and caucus going electorate doesn't seem to be buying that.
Do you think the governor is aiming for a VP slot on a possible DeSantis ticket?
Well, I will say that I've never really believed that Kim Reynolds aspires to be on a ticket, but I do think that if Ron DeSantis were the main contender to get the nomination, I think she would be on the short list for sure. I mean, she has been very influenced by what he's done on several types of laws. She has followed Florida's lead, and the rift has grown between her and Donald Trump, the public criticism. And I think that she and Ron DeSantis are just simpatico. I feel that she enjoys being governor. All of her grandkids are here, and I would be very surprised to ever see her running for federal office.
As you would expect, the former president lashed out at Governor Reynolds yesterday afternoon, Sunday, calling her disloyal and saying on social media that her endorsement of DeSantis will be, in Trump's words, the end of her political career. Do you think it will?
I don't think so. I mean, first of all, she has several years left on her current term. And Trump, this is always interesting to me that he likes to take credit. He actually does the same thing regarding Ron DeSantis. He's always claiming that DeSantis was begging for his endorsement and wouldn't have won in 2018 without him. And he mentioned yesterday that he helped Kim Reynolds become governor by appointing Terry Branstad as U.S. ambassador to China. Of course, that allowed Kim Reynolds to move from lieutenant governor to assume the powers of the governor's office and then run for election in 2018, basically as an incumbent. So, I mean, it is true that that was helpful. I can say that many political observers, myself included, always expected Terry Branstad would step down before 2018 so that Kim Reynolds would be able to compete in that election as an incumbent. But it's certainly true that Donald Trump helped facilitate that for her.
Iowa governors rarely endorse presidential candidates. Why do you think she did this time?
I think that there's a little bit of panic right now in the establishment that is not supporting Trump and wants to move on from Trump. And I think that she may have calculated this was one of the few game-changing moments that she could engineer for Ron DeSantis. I think that if his campaign were going better, we wouldn't be seeing this endorsement now. We would see it much closer to caucus night to try to generate momentum. But you are correct. It's very rare for governors in Iowa to endorse. Usually it's perceived as better to stay neutral. I should mention that Governor Terry Branstad in 2016 said that he wasn't endorsing, but he thought that people shouldn't vote for Ted Cruz because that would be bad for ethanol. And then shortly after that, Ted Cruz went on to win the Iowa caucuses.
Though he did not go on to win, of course, the presidency, yes. All right, well, Mr. DeSantis launched his first Iowa TV ad of the 2024 cycle. You have seen it.
Yes. So he was contrasting himself with Joe Biden, said that he got results, he got hostages, he got people out of Israel and back to Florida, that he successfully helped rebuild after natural disasters, and that he sent troops to the southern border. And so basically just presenting him as the main alternative. This was not an ad that drew contrast between Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump or anyone else in the Republican field.
To clarify, it was the first Iowa television ad, of course. Tim Scott was in Iowa last week, and he talked more and more about the international college students who are encouraging what he called mass murder in the Israel-Hamas conflict.
Yes. And I mean, this has become something that Republican candidates are speaking about more often. I don't know. I haven't seen numbers about how many college students who are participating in pro-Palestinian protests are foreign students on visas. My strong impression is that most of the people participating in those rallies are native-born American college students. And also, I don't think that most of the protesters are expressly supporting Hamas as opposed to supporting the idea of Palestinian statehood. But in any case, in the Republican circles right now, this has become a hot button topic to talk about, how we need to shut down these protests and we need to get people out of the country if they're here on a student visa and opposing Israel.
Meanwhile, Vivek Ramaswamy is shifting his campaign resources to Iowa. He has said the only chance we have is in Iowa. He's launching an $8 million ad buy. This is just about it for him. He's got 4% in the most recent Des Moines Register poll.
Well, typically it hasn't worked for candidates to move to Iowa. I mean, he's not the first person to get an apartment in Iowa. Senator Chris Dodd, before the 2008 caucuses, rented a home in Des Moines and was even sending his children, I think, to Des Moines public schools before the caucuses. What I find amazing about Vivek Ramaswamy is he has had quite an active campaign here, and he has done a lot of events, dozens of events in Iowa, and yet he's polling at 4%, which is the same as Chris Christie, who has not even visited the state all year. So clearly, I mean, Iowans who are seeing a lot of Vivek Ramaswamy, that not many of them are saying he's their first choice. So I'm not sure what he can do. I did see the TV ad. It condenses and repeats several of what are informally called his 10 commandments that he usually uses to wrap up his stump speech. And I just don't know. I think that those are statements that a lot, God is real, there are two genders and so on. Reverse racism is racism. I mean, they're statements that a lot of Republicans agree with, but whether that's enough to make him the first choice of more caucus goers, I'm skeptical.
Meanwhile, the latest GOP presidential debates coming up on Wednesday night. DeSantis, Haley, Ramaswamy, Christie, Scott have qualified. Mr. Trump also has qualified, but he will not be there. So does this debate mean anything?
Well, I think it means something for Tim Scott, because if he hadn't qualified, I think he would be completely out of it. And I think Chris Christie, as I just mentioned, is not really contesting Iowa at all. But for him in New Hampshire, I think it's very important, because Nikki Haley, I believe, is polling second right now in New Hampshire. So I think it is important. It'll be important for DeSantis to have a strong showing, but he is going to get some good press going into the debate because of this endorsement he just picked up in Iowa.
Meanwhile, a New York Times poll this past weekend shows Mr. Biden with vulnerability, to say the least. Trump leading Biden in Nevada by 11 points, Georgia by 6, Arizona by 5, Michigan by 5, Pennsylvania by 4. What's interesting there, of course, is that Mr. Biden carried all of these states in 2020.
So I follow a lot of election analysis people on Twitter, or the platform formerly known as Twitter, and there was a lot of arguing about this poll. I mean, one thing that I want to emphasize is that a year before the 2012 election, Barack Obama was running behind Mitt Romney, and there were some people saying it looks like Barack Obama is going to be a one-term president. So a lot can change, and we really don't know. It can go in either direction. We do not know which party is going to be benefiting from the political wins next fall. We don't know what the economy is going to be like next fall. Particularly the results for Nevada, a lot of people were discounting that. I mean, polls can be off. Another finding of the poll that raised a lot of eyebrows were that Trump was supposedly pulling 22% of the black vote, which seems rather unlikely. But, you know, we don't know. I think what it underscores, though, is that it's going to be a very competitive presidential election. And so it's for the groups that are spending a lot of money on ads saying Trump can't beat Biden and we have to dump Trump to have a chance of beating Biden, this poll shows that it will be very competitive.
An overwhelming 71% of those polls say Mr. Biden is too old to be an effective president, including 54% of his own supporters. That's going to be a problem all the way down the line.
Well, I think it will be, although arguably since Donald Trump is only 3 years younger than Joe Biden, I mean, it's not clear how much of a problem. I think that that might be a bigger problem for Joe Biden if he were up against someone from a different generation. And of course, that is part of Ron DeSantis's argument. He's only in his 40s and he can offer a different generation of leadership. I think that we've seen the Biden campaign on social media has started highlighting video clips of Donald Trump making gaffes, perhaps sounding confused, like what we talked about last week when he said he was in Sioux Falls instead of Sioux City. And I think we'll probably see more of that as pushback against the idea that Joe Biden is too old.
There were more results from the Des Moines Register Iowa polls last week. I don't think we have to go over all of this in depth, but just briefly, the GOP likely caucus goers believe extremely important issues, the economy 99%, immigration 97%, government spending in the deficit 97%. There aren't a lot of surprises here.
I thought the most interesting thing was the abortion finding, because 52% of the likely GOP caucus goers disagreed with his comments that the near total abortion ban in Florida was a terrible mistake. And yet there were quite a few people. It validated the research done by some of these anti-Trump conservative groups that a lot of people who disagree with Trump on that issue were still supporting Trump and saying that they think abortion is a very important issue, but they think maybe he didn't really mean that, or maybe, well, it doesn't matter because he appointed the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade and so on. And it was and yet also the people who are pro-choice, and there is still a substantial minority of Republican caucus goers who are pro-choice. And so for those people, it's a positive thing that Trump said that the abortion bans are a terrible mistake. So it kind of showed, I think, that support for Trump is really disconnected from people's stance on the issues.
We're going to pivot to Israel. And as part of that, the new Iowa poll last week said that a majority of likely Republican Iowa caucus goers pick former President Trump as the candidate who would do the best job of handling the Israel-Hamas war. 52% chose him, 22% chose Haley, only 9% chose Ron DeSantis.
And I think that may be partly why Ron DeSantis, in his opening Iowa TV ad, he did mention what he has done to try to help Americans get home from Israel. I think that was a good result for Nikki Haley. She has been emphasizing foreign policy a lot more in her speeches than most presidential candidates do. Of course, that's natural because she's the former UN ambassador under the Trump administration. But Donald Trump has talked a lot also about what he did for Israel, about moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and other positions that are very popular. And of course, he is out there during his stump speeches talking about banning Muslims from entering the country again and deporting people who are pro-Palestinian. And so those are popular stances with the Republican base.
And the U.S. House passed a GOP written bill last week that would tie $14 billion in military aid to Israel in its war with Hamas to domestic spending cuts. And all four Iowa GOP congressional members supported that.
Yes. And this bill, this particular format for aid to Israel is not going anywhere in the U.S. Senate. But it was funny because often when they have a spending measure, they also include a spending cut to offset it. But in this case, the spending cut, which was reduced money going to the Internal Revenue Service for enforcement, actually wasn't an offset. It would increase the deficit, according to the nonpartisan analysis from the Congressional Budget Office, because money that you spend on tax enforcement actually brings in more revenue. So this was one where the offset needed an offset, as I think one of the Democrats said. But the House and Senate are going to have to do a lot more negotiating before anything on this gets to the president's desk. Of course, President Biden and Democrats in the Senate, and in fact, even many Senate Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, would prefer to combine aid for Israel and Ukraine in one bill.
There were other votes last week. All four Iowa congressional members voted against expelling Republican George Santos of New York. He's been indicted on 23 federal charges. He's been accused of lying. His whole life has been accused of being a lie. They voted against expelling him.
Yes, and most this was expected to fail because the way it was brought to the floor, it was a kind of motion that requires a two-thirds vote to pass. And the majority of Republicans and even some Democrats voted against expelling George Santos. And one of them, Jamie Raskin, said in a statement, look, he hasn't been convicted of anything yet. And so if he's convicted on of any of these charges, that's a different story. But very few people, I think only five or six people in history, have been expelled from Congress. And three of them were expelled because of their involvement in the Civil War. And the other two had been convicted of crimes.
The House also voted to torpedo a resolution censuring Democrat Rashida Tlaib of Michigan for her harsh criticism of Israel. And she has been criticizing Israel harshly in the wake of the Hamas attack last month.
That's right. And this was an interesting one because everybody, many people on the Republican side have been critical of her comments. And yet 23 Republicans voted with Democrats on a motion to table. So that meant that they didn't actually vote on whether to censure Rashida Tlaib. And Marionette Miller-Meeks kind of had a interesting balancing act on that. She issued a statement saying that she condemned Representative Tlaib's comments and repeatedly had condemned that. And she wanted the Ethics Committee to look at that. But she didn't really address why she voted to table the motion. I got the impression that she was saying that an Ethics Committee probe should happen first, but it was rather strange. So the other three Republicans from Iowa voted with most of the Republican caucus, and they would have gone forward with this resolution to censure Representative Tlaib.
And one more note on the Israel-Hamas war. It has created a rift, a big rift between student Democrats at Iowa's two flagship universities, the U of I and Iowa State University, and Democratic state party leaders. There have been accusations of anti-Semitism, calls for resignations. This is a mess.
It really is. And I've talked to quite a few Democrats about this over the past week. And I would say nobody is happy about the situation at all, regardless of their position on what's going on in Israel and Palestine. I want to say, first of all, that the message that was posted on the University of Iowa Democrat social media was not signed by the entire leadership. It was signed by three people. And it raised a lot of concerns because it used the expression, it talked about, may every Palestinian be free from the river to the sea. And that is a charge phrase that some people associate with the destruction and extermination of Israel. These students claim that that is not the way they were using the phrase. But in any case, several Democrats had contacted the students and they'd actually already taken down the social media posts. So many people were surprised that the state party leader even put out a press release condemning it and calling for the resignation of the students involved. I mean, it's not normal for the state party to get involved in internal deliberations with a college party. And a lot of people, even those who didn't like the original statement, felt that maybe it was an overreaction for the state party to come down that hard on college students.
And after Rita Hart said that, there was a posting of an unsigned letter on the ISU College Democrats Facebook page in which it said it is disaffiliating itself from the state Democratic Party.
Yes. And I don't know really meaningfully what that would do. I mean, I don't know how much the affiliation of college Democrats with the state party affects their operations. I did talk to somebody at the big Democratic Party event on Saturday. I talked to somebody from Ames who was saying, look, I mean, we need the Story County Democrats and the Iowa State University Democrats need to be cooperating next year on getting out the vote. And this person was a little concerned that this rift could impede that kind of cooperation.
It is 18 after the hour. This is KHOA's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Arch, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. There's a lot of it. We're here every week at this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capitol, what it all means. We have plenty to talk about. We're going to rush our way through here. We talk fast sometimes. John Fetterman from Pennsylvania showed up for the Iowa Democratic Party Liberty and Justice Dinner in Altoona Saturday night. What did he have to say that was interesting?
He started with a lot of jokes near the beginning of his speech. I mean, he joked about that he was sorry to say that we got the body double, the Iowa Democrats did, because referring to the Republican conspiracy theory that he was been replaced by a body double. He joked about how former Vice President Mike Pence is opposed to abortion, but he aborted his own presidential campaign. And he took a lot of jabs at several of the Republican presidential candidates. And then what was a surprise to me was he really went hard after what he described as the two Democrats who are running against Joe Biden, but only one of them has the guts to actually be openly running against him. So that would, of course, be the member of Congress, Dean Phillips from Minnesota. But he also clearly doesn't like the way California Governor Gavin Newsom is out there. He implied that Newsom is running a shadow campaign against Joe Biden. He said, we need to get behind Joe Biden. He's been a great president. He's done a great job.
The truth is that all of us out here in California are following Mr. Newsom closely, and he is running a shadow campaign in case something happens to President Biden. And we'll see. We hope that does not happen in terms of something happening, but that's what Mr. Newsom is doing. Meanwhile,
I wanted to mention also that John Fetterman has spent some time talking about his own mental health challenges following his stroke and recovery. And he said when he speaks to a group, no matter how large or small, he always encourages people who are struggling to get help, that it's so important. Don't harm yourself and get help. And I think that was extremely well received by the audience.
So he joked about a body double replacing him, which Republican conspiracy theorists believe it would take, Laura, a body triple to replace us. That's all I can say. Meanwhile, true. Iowa Democrats could start requesting ballots for the party's mail-in presidential caucus, which is going to take place on January 15th, the same night as the Republican caucus.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many people are going to show up on January 15th for the in-person caucuses. That's going to be for the stuff like electing people to the county central committee, the platform committee, passing platform resolutions, and so on. But yes, everybody who wants to weigh in, and maybe with Dean Phillips running, I mean, who knows? Maybe there will be more people interested in getting a ballot. They're technically calling it a presidential preference card, even though it really is a ballot. But with the logistics, there's still a lot we don't know about how this is all going to work.
A body triple. All right, kind of a surprise last week in the U.S. Senate, maybe not. Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, led an attack on Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, who's been blockading the Senate from approving appointments in the military, and she just lit into him last week.
This was a very unusual spectacle. So this has been going on for 8 or 9 months in the Senate, that Senator Tuberville has been holding up military promotions. And at this point, it's affecting hundreds of positions that haven't been able to be filled. And a handful of nominations were brought to the floor about a month ago and were voted on. And for most of the year, Senator Ernst and Senator Grassley and others have avoided criticizing their colleague. And they've said, hey, look, you know, the majority leader can bring these nominations to the floor anytime and have individual votes. And the reason why they were so angry last week is they brought 61 nominations to the floor, and Senator Tuberville individually blocked unanimous consent on all of them. And so that is why Senator Joni Ernst and some of her Republican colleagues, they were all people who had served in the military themselves. They were very harsh in their criticism, and they said that this was hurting military readiness. And in fact, at one point, this was a clip that I saw that got shared a lot of social media, where Joni Ernst said, I really respect men of their word, and I do not respect men who do not honor their word. I believe that was referring to the idea that Tommy Tuberville had indicated that he would allow these nominations to go forward on individual votes, but instead he blocked them all last week.
Meanwhile, back to Iowa, in the 3rd Congressional District, incumbent Zach Nunn, Republican, is considered to be perhaps vulnerable next year in the congressional races. And yet, as of this moment on this Monday night, Democrats have not announced a challenger for him, but now someone is in the wings, apparently.
Yes. Well, I think multiple people have been seriously considering it. And I expect that probably more than one Democrat will file for this seat. But so far, the Des Moines Register published an article last week about former USDA official Lanon Bacom. He said he acknowledged that he's seriously thinking about jumping into the race. I mean, we're in the middle of the fourth quarter. And I think that if somebody is going to announce, they probably should do it before the holiday season gets into full swing.
What does it say that Mr. Bacom is relatively unknown and that others have not jumped in?
Well, I think at this point, it's pretty clear that some of the better known contenders like Teresa Greenfield, who was the 2020 nominee for U.S. Senate, she was someone who was talked about as a possible candidate in the 3rd District. So I think it's clear that she's passed on this, that several well-known people like state legislators have passed on this. And yes, as you mentioned, he is relatively unknown. So I think that shows that it's considered, even though Zach Nunn is the most vulnerable Republican in Iowa. And even though he won his 2022 race by less than 1% of the vote, it still is going to be a big challenge to unseat him. I mean, at this stage in 2018, there were literally seven Democrats seeking the Democratic nomination to take on David Young.
All right, let's talk about elections. If you're listening to us live on Monday night, we hope you are. There are city council, mayoral, and school board elections tomorrow, November 7th. If you're listening to us on Tuesday morning, November 7th, it's today. So Iowans are going to be able to vote in a variety of elections all across the state tomorrow. Polls open 7 a.m. in the morning till 8 at night. Absentee ballots have to be in there at the polls by 8 o'clock. So Laura, what do we expect turnout-wise on this?
Usually turnout is low, although they, since they combined school board and city council elections a few years ago, that has bumped up the turnout. There's been quite a lot of spending on local races. I heard from the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Executive Director last Friday, and he said that his staff, they're seeing much more contentious local elections compared to a few years ago. They're seeing a lot of spending on these races. And I wanted to emphasize you that the polls will be open tomorrow from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. It's really important that people bring some kind of voter ID with them to vote, especially if they've changed their address. They need to bring ID and also proof of residency, something like a utility bill, a bank statement, or a lease to show that they actually live at that address. And if you have your absentee ballot, do not put it in the mail now. It's extremely important to either hand deliver it to the county auditor tomorrow, or if you have an incomplete absentee ballot, you can surrender that at your regular polling place and then vote with a regular ballot.
You know, I've seen these crazy slogans, vote early and vote often. You know, if you vote often, that's illegal.
It is illegal. And I mean, we haven't had a real problem. I mean, one good thing about an off-year election like this, it's very unlikely that you would ever have to wait in line to vote. Even if you're voting right before work or right after work, which tend to be the busiest times, it's usually not too crowded. But it can be somewhat difficult to find information about city council and school board candidates because they're not the most heavily covered races. And in a lot of the races, other than yard signs and maybe a few flyers, voters don't have much information about the candidates. But I'll be watching the school board races most closely because there are a lot of school districts where candidates are almost running on a slate that would be, let's say, affiliated with Moms for Liberty or conservative candidates who support Governor Reynolds and the Republican legislature's agenda for schools. And then a slate of candidates that have been endorsed by the main teachers union, Iowa State Education Association, who don't support many of the laws that have been passed relating to education and are going to be trying to interpret those in what they view as the least harmful way for public schools. So I think it's interesting that these elections will be seen almost as a referendum on what the governor and the legislature did this year.
A couple of minutes left. You wrote about dark money trying to buy the Des Moines mayoral race. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so there are four candidates running for mayor of Des Moines, but the two who are the best known and the best funded are city council members, Connie Bozen and Josh Mandelbaum. And the race, I mean, it has been somewhat contentious, but I would say overall, I mean, it's certainly not the harshest campaign I've ever seen in Polk County. But last Thursday, a number of readers contacted me to say that they received a mailing. It was by a group they'd never heard of, Citizens for Des Moines. It turns out to be a brand new group that just registered with the Secretary of State, but it hasn't filed any campaign finance disclosures, even though it's now sent out at least two mailings targeting Josh Mandelbaum in this race and it not disclosing their donors. So there are a lot of questions about that. I explained this is something that a lot of advocacy groups do. This is clearly literature designed to influence the election, but it doesn't say don't vote for Josh Mandelbaum. It says call Josh Mandelbaum and tell him such and such. So that is a way that they can avoid overt electioneering and therefore skirt campaign finance disclosure requirements, because normally a political action committee like that would be required to periodically disclose their donors and details about their spending.
And 1 minute, voters in the central Iowa community of Pella are going to decide whether to give their city council more say over what books the public library can offer.
Yes, and this was a challenge to the most challenged book in the country, I believe, Gender Queer. Residents of Pella, they didn't like that this book was in the library. By the way, it was in the adult section of the library, not the children's section. And the library board considered this objection and then rejected it. They decided to leave the book on the shelves. And so that led to people lobbying the city council and getting a special referendum declared that's going to coincide with tomorrow's election, where they will decide whether the city council in Pella has the authority to overrule decisions of the library board. And clearly it is aimed at decisions over whether books should be removed from the shelves. Now, Pella is one of the most conservative towns in the state. So this is one where you would have to say that the supporters of this would be favored. On the other hand, I know that there has been a spirited local campaign to try to oppose the referendum. So I will be watching those results as well.
Oh my, the GOP debate, elections in Iowa, who knows what else. We'll have it all next Monday night again.
Yes, looking forward to discussing it with you.
All right, Laura, we are out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be back here, indeed we will, in the same time slot next week. And as usual, we're going to talk about everything interesting or important or even entertaining that takes place in Iowa politics, and there's always a lot of that. And as always, you can join us. We hope you can. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it. We value it. Between now and next time, be sure to vote on Tuesday, but only once. And we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week.